Now, we've been doing brilliantly on the rugby fields of late. When I say we, I mean they, actually, but we take pride in it. On the soccer front, the results have been disappointing, to say the least, leading to the departure of the Republic of Ireland managers Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane last month. And all of this has left people wondering what can be done for the future of soccer in Ireland. Well, my first guest this morning has come up with what he thinks could be the beginning of a solution. He's played football for Ireland himself 92 times, had a great career in the Premier League, and continues to work as a pundit and a businessman. Niall Quinn, welcome to the studio.
Thank you,
Marian. Nice to see you.
You too.
You've been speaking recently about a way that this could be addressed. I was looking up the history of what rugby did when they went professional and how they got their structures. It looks like we're heading nowhere at the moment.
Yeah, but it's you know, not something to be looking back on and giving out about. It's all about the future and how can we improve structures. And, you know, I come home here, people might ask, why is Niall Quinn doing that? He was in England all his life with football. But I've been home here. I worked in the UK in football. Virgin Media gave me an opportunity earlier this year to speak to an Irish audience. We cover European football and national, international football. But I felt it was appropriate, you know, to look deeper at the Irish structures and in some way attempt to widen the debate about where our problems really lie. And this is not, I'm not here to knock the FAI and look backwards. It's about what can we do, where are we now, and how can we make improvements. And as a media person, I think it's appropriate to have that debate, but then also to add something to debate and find solutions. So I was invited to speak at the PFAI award ceremony, which is the awards that the players themselves have where they vote their own player of the year, which is a huge event in the UK, and they have so much power, the PFA in the UK, for their players. It's frightening compared to the Irish branch, but they asked me along, and I felt there was something more needed than just to say, pat them on the back and say they did well. Maybe look at pathways, maybe look at structures. And that was the start where it got interesting for me, because I started to look at tax breaks and how other industries were in pretty poor shape, and particularly here at home, and needed a boost. And, you know, you look at what happened to them. You look at the film industry, for instance, you know. You look at horse racing. You know, not just, we haven't just got great horses and jockeys as a result, we have great vets, we have every part and every component.
The infrastructure
is incredible. Even hotels, we had no hotels, if you remember, before the boom. And the breaks that made everything happen. And I just felt football deserved a shot at that, because it's the largest participated sport in Ireland.
Yeah, you know, you should stress that, really. It's 400...
They say 470,000... participants every weekend. You just look at the type of day that's out there today now coming in here.
They're
blown out of it. They're welcome to it in some ways. But all over the country there will be soccer matches played again this weekend. And the people who are putting all that in place and keeping it together deserve great respect, a great, you know, sort of effort. But there should be a better solution and a better system. And if we look at what happened, like, you know, I'll put it this way. That's a great point. You've actually reminded me of something there. I don't see 470,000 people out shooting films every weekend, yet that industry got its break. So I think there's a question to be asked. But then obviously to fulfill, you know, a pathway towards that, you have to come up with reasonable structure and reasonable, I suppose, pathways for our young players to say, if money was put into it, that it would work.
Yeah. If you take what was the traditional route, mm-hmm. you know, kids played on the footpath on the street, wherever they played, then they kind of got involved. Then they got scouted.
Yes.
Like yourself. Mm-hmm. And then they went to England.
Yeah.
And the notion that they would, that the real talent would stay at home, didn't seem to cross anybody's mind.
No, and other things attached to that is, you know, education was forgotten about. They were plucked away at 15, 16 years of age. I was 16 myself. And 9 out of 10 come home before they've even matured as a human being, they're failures. And the League of Ireland picked up a lot of players like that and got them going again. But somewhere in there, the system was broken, because even though players, you know, might be a little bit later to develop, come through the League of Ireland. You know, Seamus Coleman, for instance, being a classic example. Why did he only cost €60,000 when 2 or 3 years later there's talk of him going for €26 million now that he proved himself? So there tells you that there's a real problem in our structures and what people value us, how the outside world looks at our structures. And this is not a go at the FAI. It's very important that I say that this, what this is about doing is trying to find a dynamic change in what could happen in terms of the pathways for young players. We must give our young soccer players a viable alternative to the boat to doom, because quite frankly, they are not getting the boat now to the top clubs in the numbers that they used
because
to.
Because they're not, because South America is their
Yes, the world, exactly. Yeah. And so what you have now, they're going to lower middle level clubs in the UK structure. And in some cases, it's not that much better than the League of Ireland at all. So what can be done to do that? And I looked at other models. You know, the Iceland model is absolutely incredible. You look at, I did some European football during the week, three nights. There was Iceland players playing every night in countries all around Europe. How did that happen? They have a much smaller population than us, but the government invested. They invested in coaching infrastructures. You know, the FAI are left to do that on their own with the amount of money they have. They also have the stadium to pay. You know, they're in a pretty tough space. But what the government have done there, if you join a soccer club in Iceland, just think about this: you're 5 years of age. You have an A-licensed coach who is paid to coach you. Now, we're producing A-licensed coaches here, but we have no work for them. We have no system that will see them paid. I know one in particular who paid €7,000 in total to get his coaching badges, but he's still at the local community centre with a club who can't afford to pay him. So we have to move away from
How does the money work? What's the relationship between the FAI, the league, and the schoolboys?
Well, the FAI own the league in many respects. They run the league. They have 100% control of the league. And that in itself causes a problem. It was interesting to see John Delaney quoted during the week at an event he went to saying that they would rather see a day when they didn't run it and it was independently run. And I think that's right, because if you think about it, the FAI can't work perfectly for all clubs. You know, I see recently they announced that they were they'd got some money from Dublin County Council, I think, and they were going to pass that on to Bohemians. Well, if I was Cork or if I was Limerick or if I was Galway, you know, I'd be saying, well, what about us? When are you going to give us that amount of money? So it's a very difficult position. I think they did very well, I think, at a time where they said they'd come in and we'll rescue it, we'll keep the League of Ireland going. So I'm not, this isn't a go at the FAI over that. But if we could see ourselves, I think, go back to the tax break and why people would invest here. You know, if you look at a multinational, you know, maybe through a genuine care and a CSR program, they could actually, you know, have a shot to nothing at supporting something like this. If you put a tax break in place for clubs and did it from the bottom up and insisted that every club spent it on they use the word academy now, I don't like that word, I think police academy when I see the word academy,
but
in our structures.
That.
Yeah, to provide pathways for young people, but not just that they would be really well coached, that they get their education. A viable alternative to the system now that sees us either dumped over in England and back with not much to go, or look, the one in so many, one in 20 that actually go and make it. That's fine, but there's, of the 20, 30 that went in the boat, there's probably hundreds more that weren't far away from that, weren't scouted at the right time. So there's a great opportunity to put the structure in, copy the Icelandic model, the Norwegian model. You know, Norway sold a player to Cardiff from their Premier League a few years ago for €10 million. You know, can you imagine that coming into our country? And we're right beside it now. The big problem, of course, has been for 25, 26 years we've been in the shadow of the Premier League here. There's no doubt about that. It's in our faces. It's really difficult. And you mentioned the rugby, and they were brilliant. They joined in a Europe-wide system and were part of a great system. The GAA don't have, you know, a GAA Premier League in the UK killing it every week. And therefore, is another compelling reason why the government should show sympathy here, because it's the, you know, as I say, the 470,000 participants prove to you that this is a massive industry that needs help down at the bottom. And if you started from the young players up, if you were to build academies, we call it that, if you were to build them in every League of Ireland club, but you were to give money to the clubs via a centralised system that insisted on a certain standard of academy being built. Now, some of them are doing great work, by the way. I was out at Shamrock Rovers Academy, and it's just amazing what's going on. So despite limited circumstances, there is some good stuff going. But if you could centralise it, put a powerful message of intent and bring, you know, as I say, tax breaks to people who would invest in that. And
who
players
would
through.
Invest?
Well, I would look at multinationals. I would look at external, you know, businesses that would probably have a tax bill here that could turn the tax bill into something more productive. So that's the start of it. And in, you know, maybe in a couple of years that everybody had to be Academy A status, everybody had to have an education facility for any young players. But even deeper than that, that, you know, in a region, that region is automatically affiliated to a League of Ireland club, and that the players, you know, are given the choice to come through and get into a system, whether it's under 13, under 15, under 17, that by the time they're really selected at the top of that Christmas tree at sort of 16 years of age, that they enter into a place where our rugby lads go. Our rugby lads get great coaching, they get great, they build themselves up physically, but they're also heading for university. They're also heading to become real strong characters. We don't. We send boys over to England. So if we can push that that play, so the League of Ireland club is now responsible for more than just winning games on a Saturday.
Yeah.
That they have an educational responsibility for their players. And then you're offering that viable alternative to the boat. I know as parents, a parent myself, you know, my son had a little go up the ladders and that, how difficult it is when somebody comes along and says, oh, we'll give you a year in York City.
Right.
Okay. And you go, wow, you have to give up everything for a crack at this sort of dream in the lower leagues. And very hard to turn it down. But that's where I think the taxpayer can really start to come in. If you give a viable alternative to that and you create young, fine young men who have, you know, been really football trained excellently, where the clubs in England trust you, and then suddenly your league gets the I suppose the upside of that, you know, that the players are coming in, it's far more exciting. The clubs themselves at the top end, I think something can be done there too. There's a lovely little known policy here in Irish government where we have an immigration investor support scheme where I think it's lined up for business, really. But a businessman can come into this country, he can pay €1 million, he can stay for 5 years. The €1 million goes to charitable causes, and if he stays law abiding for 5 years and is seen as an advantage to the country, he receives an Irish passport. If we could attract young footballers from around the world into that scene who can't quite come to Europe because they haven't got the passports, etc., and they haven't got enough international games played because they can't qualify, you know, to overcome that, we could be, this could be a lovely sort of haven for young Brazilian players, you know, young African players who are trying to find their way and who would really bolster our league. Put it this way, can you imagine once a year having a draft, as they call it in American football, and having every club, because of this money that's come in, they were able to bring in and attract all these exciting players from around the world, and the club who finished last in the league last year, they get the first pick right the way through to the team who wanted to get the last pick. It would be so exciting. It would be taking on and challenging what's happened to the game over the last 25, 6 years. So you can go from the bottom with what they did in Iceland, put great facilities in, you know. And here's the thing, Iceland have all the disadvantages against them. They have the weather, as you know, the darkness, half the amount a year. You know, they're putting in imaginative stuff that is really paying dividends. And we're sitting, you know, with these kind of ideas that I'm throwing at you here. You know, it needs feasibility studies, it needs working groups, it needs to be put in there. But there is a hugely compelling reason why football in this country should look at itself from the bottom upwards. And I was doing a lot of research, as I knew I was coming on the show with you, and I found a bit of research that said our schoolboy league in Dublin paid $500,000 to the FAI.
Say that to me again.
Our schoolboy league in Dublin paid €500,000 to the FAI. So
where did they get it?
From the enrolment fees for children from under 8 to under 16, whatever it was, all through the clubs. You know, they have their system of making their own money. But that was to give them the ability to play up at Abbottstown, where the FAI have their system. And it finished off the bill, and the FAI were able to complete Abbottstown because of that. Now, that's the total inverse of what should be happening. The FAI, in theory, should be spending $500,000 down to the leagues to get better players. And that just tells you how stuck our problem is. That's not criticising the FAI. The FAI needed that money. They're always in need of money. I know that. That is a system that I'm saying needs looking at.
Yeah, just give me that again. But how do the schoolboys get the money?
So all the clubs would, you know, any club would have under 8s, under 9s, under 10s all the way up, and every player has a fee that they must pay every year to be a member of that club, and that goes on into the league, and the league then has sponsors, etc., and does its thing, and it's great work. Dublin District Schoolboy League, I mean, in my time, absolutely brilliant. But there seems to be a disconnect in many ways in that, you know, as I said to you, the structure is fractured as it works its way up. But to think where we are and why the government should intervene, I'll give you that little nugget that the Schoolboys League in Dublin itself paid for the right and the ability to play matches at Abbottstown. It should be the other way around. In every other country in the world, the association would have the needs and the wherewithal to drop money back to make the leagues bigger and better. Now, that was 3 or 4 years ago, so some time ago. But at the same time, therein lies how are we ever going to get going if that's the type of system that our association are expected to thrive with. And again, this is about forward dynamic thinking. It's about looking at ways of improving the game from the bottom up.
Yeah.
And the FAI are not to be held totally accountable here just for the sake of having a go with people. They need assistance, and the assistance could come from government in the form of a tax break for an industry that's deserving of a break because of participation levels, because of what it means when the senior team do right. well, etc. But it's not going too well now.
But if you was in preparation for this, I was reading quotations from Liam Brady, and he was talking about when he was running the academy, and that when the Irish kids came over. Mm-hmm. They were very much behind
yeah.
the English kids. Now, he said clubs understood that and they gave them a break. But you don't want to be behind. You want to be kind of...
That's exactly it. So Liam spoke about that, and he spoke about how the association hadn't come over to look at themselves and see how it went. But then, you know, the association haven't got, as I said, the money and the power to start putting all these systems in place. Brian Marwood at Manchester City, another big club, said to me, we just don't trust the Irish system anymore. That said, they paid a lot of money. They broke the mould and paid a lot of money for young Gavin Bazinazou. Who's going over after he's completed his education. So they're taking a chance on him because he was so good, got into the League of Ireland team at 16, kept a load of clean sheets, looks a man already. So they made an exception, but they're not entirely trustworthy of our systems right now that our schoolboy clubs are in. So that's the message itself that needs to be taken on board.
Have you lobbied the government at all on this?
No. How this came about, I was asked to speak at that PFA I do, and I just didn't want to go and pat the lads on the back. I wanted to leave something meaningful, and I'm really pleased that it was picked up. I don't have all the answers here, but already I've had a lot of people get in touch with me. There's a feasibility group about to be set up, and even a group that create academies all around the world. They've built one in Vietnam and one in South Africa, a group called Red Strike. They've come in and sort of said, look, we'll show you the model, how it can all be done, so that education becomes just as important as the coaching. If you can imagine, going back to the ISON model I spoke to you about, can you imagine every kid going into every club in the country and having an A-licensed coach, bringing them from 5 years of age to the point of releasing them maybe into the League of Ireland Academy setup at a particular club in their region? Then you'll have English clubs very interested. But more importantly, if you bring in Brazilian players, you bring in other players as well at the top end to make it even more attractive, suddenly you won't be charging 60,000 as Sligo Rovers had to for Seamus Coleman. You'll be charging 6 million. And that's the idea. Is there a dynamic belief?
One of the things I realised is that to get by, obviously money is very tight all over the place in this, that if a young lad is spotted at 16 and taken, his club gets the money. Now, it's not mega money, but it's very important money to them. But it might be only 40 grand or 60 grand.
But that's the point. We should have that taken care of where that's not as important. And we should have a system in place where, you know, it's a bigger play. We're selling ourselves way too cheaply, you know. And the Sligo Rovers, Seamus Coleman example is there. You know, there are other players that have gone for buttons from this league and have gone on to be worth a fabulous amount of money. And the hope is that they'll be sold on and that they might get a cut of the fee in time, and then it drops down. Some of it drops down to the schoolboy club that they played. It's you know, it's a structure. It's a little bit, I suppose, about it's a poor mouth, really, in some respects, you know, and we've got to come out of that ourselves and not expect just that, you know, the English clubs will give us more money just because we ask them.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to prove that it deserves more money. And Iceland is the typical, and Norway, you know, these are countries when they sell a player from their league. Their league is not much better than ours. It is not, you know.
Is it not?
Not at all, no. And I'm actually of the belief that Dundalk are going to prove that in very near times, I hope. But it's how we've had this Stone Age structure in place that from, you know, I think the association's 100 years old next year, but it's from the start of time, really, with our football, that players were going over on the boat with this sort of, you know, okay, they're a cheap, easy option for us. We've now gone from being a cheap, easy option to say, well, we don't really trust you in the Premier League anymore that much. Our standard of where our player, the standard of club that we go to is lower.
Yeah.
It's time to wake up. We're entering into a new era. And the Premier League has been a huge shadow. You know, there's no blame attached here. We just have to think differently. But that said, there are a number of players, as young Kelleher at Liverpool, Troy Parrott at Spurs, Masterson's in the Liverpool squad today. There is hope out there, but we've got to stop living on hope. We've got to put structures in place to make it dynamic and to have... I'd love to see hundreds of A-licensed coaches operating all over the globe. This is an amazing statistic. One in 500 players in Iceland, there's an A-licensed coach for one in every 500 players. I think it's one in every 5,000 here. So, right. So therein tells you where okay. we could go.
Okay, and that would certainly change things. The funny thing is about it's at the other end. I listened to a very moving interview about a young lad that was sent home at 19, you know, and his hopes dashed and how difficult it was. And if you went over at 16 or 17, I presume it was very lonely.
Well, I went. Luckily, I went to my auntie and uncle's house to live. Matty and Ailish, they were brilliant to me. That was a huge difference benefit to some of the other kids who were going into hostels or going into a landlady situation where, you know, they were, you know, unprepared for that. I was really lucky. That was a massive help to get. But I've seen it. But I've been guilty of it too. I brought players over as chairman of Sunderland. We had a lot of young Irish players over, and we gave a little bit of an education process on the side for them. But more often than not, it wasn't appropriate and adequate to deal with the sort of rejection that comes, and you know, you need to bounce into another. And what I say to players now, or to parents more so, that if they have to go for it and they can't say no to their son, that they insist a fallback position in the contract whereby the club will pay university fees for the player going forward if he is sent home before he's 19 years of age. Something like that.
Chance,
that's about as far as you can go. But we should be doing better than that. We should be saying to the English clubs, no, these players are fine here. They're going to play in the League of Ireland for a year or two. You're going to come and you're going to pay £2 million for them, and you're going to look after them a lot better than getting them on the cheap.
Right. How big a thrill was it to be scouted?
Well, it was great. Hurling was my sport, you know, and I hadn't played a full soccer match since the school's final in Tolka Park for Drimna Castle, my school. We beat Ballymun Comprehensive in May. I went off playing hurling. I went to Australia in the meantime and played Aussie Rules football. I came back and played the minor hurling final. And Tuesday after the minor hurling final in September, the Arsenal scouts came and said, will you come next week to Arsenal? And I hadn't played a game since May. And I went, I'm going to go. And whatever happened, it just worked for me in the trial. And I came back. I had a 3-year contract and suddenly I was a footballer. So there was no emerging talent programmes, there was no AA coaching, but you could do it in those days. Kevin Moran was a great Gaelic footballer who switched codes
as
well.
That's right, yeah.
But here was the amazing thing. The Arsenal scout said to me many, many moons later, I only went to that match to look at one of the Ballymun players. So luck is a bit to do with it as well.
Yeah, it certainly does. Well, I think talent doesn't go astray either. And then at the end of it, you were in Sunderland and there was a change of manager and he just said,
yeah, good luck. And I reacted very badly to that because I actually believed in my own hype then. I thought I was Mr. Sunderland and I was devastated. And instead of dealing with it properly and coming home and working out a plan, maybe joining another club and finishing out my career with a plan for the future, I just went home, told Gillian we'll get everything in the horse box, and we arrived back in Ireland on the Monday. So that was my preparation. That
from Saturday to Monday?
From Saturday to Monday, yeah. That's exactly how I prepared for it. And I had a tough time. Luckily, I got through it. Gillian was a star in that respect. But it wasn't easy, and I don't expect sympathy for this. It's just,
because
I was totally unprepared for it all.
The statistics of guys, because it's men we're talking about, that come to the end of their career are fairly startling.
Oh, there's some awful
financially
stuff there.
And home life.
Yeah, 2 in 5 divorced, 3 in 5 will tether on bankruptcy, if not visit bankruptcy.
Because people think of, you know, you're leaving that. We read about the fees and you think, well, you're set up for life now.
Yeah.
You'd
be set up for life if we had a system in place where the players were almost like the rugby players, where they were university driven in their education and in what they wanted. And if they used their sport to go to something brilliant afterwards, that message is lost in the playground dressing rooms that exist in football. And they're an adult playground, you know, and there is no, I can remember one day I read the Guardian newspaper in the dressing room one day and I got hammered for it for about 3 years, you know, because I wasn't reading one of the tabloids, you know. That whole mentality is just, it's for the birds. And that's what I'm saying, you know. When I speak to parents who say, oh, my son has, you know, been asked to go to Aston Villa, I say to him, this is what you're leading him into. I was there, I was part of it. I was the biggest clown in the dressing room for many years. But luckily, over a period of time, I kind of got my head together and I kind of found that I have to find another pathway now. I didn't sit and sulk for too long. But a lot of people get succumbed by it. And then when the marriage breaks up, it gets even worse. And the whole spiral of, you know, the glory.
Really. Yeah,
the glory and the pat on the back and the lights, you know, your name covered in
your
lights.
Your God, kind of.
Next day, it's all over. It's really, really tough. And again, you know, there's work to be done there as well. But at the same time, and as I said, I don't expect sympathy for that, you know, how we prepare our footballers, and indeed other sportsmen, it's just not confined to soccer, how we prepare them for the afterlife. It's a bit of a joke, but again, you would think that they should do more about it themselves. They don't.
Right, yeah. Was it always going to be to come back to Ireland?
Yeah, absolutely. We came back as often as we could. You know, obviously Gillian was from here, I was from here, and we kind of made a decision. You know, the kids were 9 and 6 when on that Saturday when I finished, and we said, come on, we'll go back. But one thing we hadn't allowed for was, you know, in Ireland then the boom was huge and all the schools were booked up. People were putting names down from the time they were born.
Yeah.
And so we had to search really long and far to find schools. But luckily it worked out great for us in terms of the kids. We found a lovely small school up in Killeshea, which you might know. And
yeah.
then following that then for secondary school, we couldn't get into any secondary school, but there was a lovely Gael Cloche down the Curragh.
Oh, lovely.
Which was great because our kids then immersed themselves. You know, they came back 9 and 6, 2 little English accents and, you know, totally uncertain as to why their mum and dad had brought them here.
Yeah.
But then within a short space of time, you know, Aisling was a member of Cunner and Gaelge. She was going around speaking at various clinics and stuff about how, you know, what Irish means to her. So, and we got great pride out of that. She's doing great now. She got her law degree and promptly told us she didn't want to do law, as all parents want to hear, of course.
Yeah.
But she's finding her way really well. Mikey is too. He's played with, you know, he's wore the Dublin jersey with the Dublin Miners and the 21s. And we sit back now sometimes and go, yeah, it was the right thing to do. Weren't we lucky, you know?
That, yeah. But then you went back.
Oh, well, I went back to work. Gillian kicked me out. It's right, you better get some money now. So this is all very well living in this dream world. So I went back initially for TV. Sky TV brought me back and I was going over once or twice a week. But then the draw and the lure, the appeal of Sunderland and what I had learnt up there and what I had witnessed, and it had started to dip. So I put a group together and we ended up buying a club. But funny enough, the initial group were put together to try and do something at Shamrock Rovers. That's how it all started. Shamrock Rovers weren't in their stadium. There was a standoff. You might remember all that up at Talla. And we first of all got together to see could we do something about that and help Shamrock Rovers. But then we weren't really encouraged. So we said, right, we'll go, we'll have a look. And we got invited into a bidding war to get Sunderland, and we liked what we saw. Likes of Charlie Chalk, Louis Fitzgerald, Sean McGrath, they were absolutely brilliant. They supported me and novice to go back and have a cut at making the club, you know, a Premier League club again. And there the whole story gets better. Roy Keane came in. It was fairy tale stuff in many ways and a great period of my life. But yeah, you're right, I left. I was for 6 years. I missed a real big part of our kids growing up in the pursuit of more pats on the back, I guess, you know.
Well, and how long did you stay in Sunderland?
I had about 6 years in Sunderland, 6 years. From about 2006, maybe not quite six, 2006 to 2011.
Yeah. And you worked with Mick McCarthy.
Yeah,
you played with him and you played under him.
Yeah, I played with him. He was always the leader, the serious one, and the one who didn't put up with the playground messing, as I spoke to you. You know, he was always very authoritative and he was management material from the day I met him. And it's no surprise that he's gone on to have the managerial career he's had. He's never got the big club with billions to throw away on players like the Mourinhos of this world. He's always done a really good job at, I suppose, keeping everything balanced, keeping players, you know, in check. I suppose providing better advice for them throughout their careers, coaching them well. And I point back to his time at Ireland because it was a watershed moment when Jack Charlton left the scene. A lot of players had come over the top at that point.
Yeah.
And Mick didn't inherit huge amounts of talent and ready to go. But what he did was great. He started adding players to it. People came along that we hadn't really heard of. Kenny Cunningham, for instance, Ian Hart. All these players went on to have great careers for Ireland. Gary Breen, you know, there was so many of them. I was looking at Keith O'Neill. There was about 11 or 12 that he brought in those early periods and almost made them good international players before they'd become good club players. And I think that's a great strength of his. And the only worry I would have is I don't think he has a lot of time to do that given the structure of the appointment in that Stephen.
Yeah, what do you think of that two-year thing?
I think it's great to know that Stephen Kenny is coming in and that we can build and he can learn off it. But just putting a date on it was the peculiar part in my reckoning. You know, looking at it, I think I can see why they did it. It's an each-way bet, a classic each-way bet. You know, if this one doesn't work out, we have another one. Two-horse race, we'll back the two of them. But at the same time, Mick could be going really, really well. And then I don't know what's going to happen. Like, will Mick McCarthy walk away from a team that's just qualified for the Euros and had a great time at the Euros and everybody's in love with it, you know, and is it right to take that risk? That's the one where it's a little bit tricky. But look, it's a good problem to have, I guess, right, down the road. Wish them both well. And I'm delighted for League of Ireland football that Stephen Kenny is up in and around it and being recognised.
He's obviously brilliant.
Hugely talented guy. And again, at that PFAI awards dinner, he was manager of the year for the umpteenth time. And he got up and he was asked a question about the year. He said, I'd rather speak about the homeless people that I stepped across on the way in here tonight and let us all go home and think about that rather than patting them. And I just thought, wow, what a class act.
Yeah, he certainly is. And a lot of people are very excited about him, you know. I'd say they're not one bit happy in Dundalk.
No, but absolutely. I also heard they didn't get a compensatory fee either. The FAI got in there, took their man and are out. But that's Irish football.
I think that Niall's point is, this is from a caller, I think that Niall's point is brilliant and I'm a huge fan of the work that local soccer coaches and league teams do. As Niall says, it needs a bottom-up approach where funds and supports are invested locally. Well, I was kind of shocked going through all this stuff and how difficult it is to work out the finances, because there just isn't a lot of money, it seems. Marion, the problem with FAI surely is the fact that all public focus goes on the international team. Now, I saw a number of people saying that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's the top of the pile and everybody feels that that's going well. It means everything else is going well. And there was spin-offs way back in the day when, you know, when Jack Charlton's team did very well, you know, the Robbie Keane's and the Damien Duff's came along. And the Richard, but they came because they were playing on the street. It was really interesting to hear Robbie Keane announcing his retirement, I was a street footballer.
Yeah.
So you don't see street football anymore. So with the lack of street football, what's in its place? That's the
question.
That's the question. And that caller is, or that texter rather, is absolutely right. We're too focused on what happens up at the top and it kind of gets things out of perspective. You know, if we go away and have a qualify for a tournament and our 40,000 fans go and have a ball and we're the best fans in the world, the team will play with great heart and pride, but it's masking and hiding an issue that I don't think is the FAI's entire problem. I think circumstances have brought it to that, and I'd love the government, you know, to stand up and look at that and give it the shot in the arm it needs.
Okay, Marion, I do hope the top echelons of Irish soccer are listening to one of Ireland's greatest. Tap into his experience and brains, and that comes from Gus and Nace, so he could be a neighbour. great to hear, Niall, but in my opinion, the FAI have little interest in the League of Ireland and in schoolboy football. Now, that's not the first time I've heard that. What's the heart of that complaint?
Well, it appears that way when all the stuff we read about in the papers is about, you know, Mick McCarthy, Martin O'Neill, Roy Keane, etc. So publicly we're drawn into that top part of the game here, but the industry as a whole here doesn't get enough. Now, there are some really good articles that kind of go by. Daniel MacDonald, The Independent, wrote a really good article about the fact that the FAI now have taken over the schoolboy structure where there's under 13, under 15, under 17 national leagues, but what happens? The kid is only just over 13 and has to go and play in under 15. He's 2 years behind, and there's a lot of complications that it wasn't a year. So there are people looking into it, and it's getting a bit of press, but yeah, it's overriding that you know, how the first team does is everything. You know, press conferences, tons of cameras clicking all the time. And of course, you know, Roy, for the few years that he was here, he gave his own press conference before every international, and we got sidetracked by that. And I feel there is work being done. You know, I know that the public persona is that there's not. I do know there's great work. I know there's great people. There should be a lot more of it, and it should be more encouraged. Right. And the government should insist on it. And we should have a real clear view of how this football mess that the game is in, because it is. We have to say it's in a mess. And people who say it's not, you know, I know because my administrative roles that I did in England, I was in Premier League meetings every month. Okay, so I know how the bigger clubs think. We have to get it into a position, A, that those bigger clubs like us and really feel what we're doing is correct. B, we're also educating our kids so they can deal with the knocks and they can have careers afterwards. And it'll just need a tax break. They did it for the film industry. I don't know, whoever got that in, whoever was in films who got that, fair play to you. But I think it's more compelling that it's done in football.
Right. Do you think Roy just took too much attention while he was in that role?
I think Martin O'Neill was the manager and he let that happen to probably just take a bit of pressure off the players, etc. And so you had the Roy interview before every game. That took up headlines for the next couple of days, and then suddenly the game started. So it was kind of a ploy at the time, but I think it all took its toll then in the end, because a few years in, after all these, then obviously he had his problem with the players that became public, which was unfortunate, because, you know, all football clubs will tell you, you know, once that starts happening, you know, it's a disaster. So, it's not ideal. Roy is more than that. He's bigger than that. He's better than that. And I haven't spoken to him for a long time. But the reality is, I saw him at his best as manager of Sunderland, and I'd love to see him as a number one. He's a number one. He's not a number two, not in a million years.
Right, okay. Would you get involved with the FAI?
No, I wouldn't.
A lot of callers
asking
that.
No, I wouldn't. No, I've said this many times before. It's a political organisation. And I remember there recently, I was at one of the matches and I opened up the inside cover of the programme, and it was thanks to our officers, and there was about 140, which I'd call blazers, that were being honoured at the back of the programme. I went, wow, imagine having to get things by all of them. Which and fair play to John Delaney, he does it. I mean, politically, he's a statesman almost. He's making great gains in UEFA and FIFA, and it must be said, you know, bringing matches to Ireland for big tournaments. There's a lot to be said for that. But again, it's all popped up at the top of the Christmas tree, as I call it. Down at the bottom of the Christmas tree, you know, the presents are falling off onto the ground, and we need to do something about it.
Great to hear, Niall, but in my opinion, the FAI have little interest. Oh, I read that before. The aim seems to be to get them to England or play international. The clubs don't seem to matter, and that's from Mohill.
Great. That's a great statement. And so my point is that these academies then are automatically linked to all the clubs around. So you've got the choice. If you're a player on the outskirts of Limerick, you're entitled to go to Limerick Academy if you're good enough, and Limerick are entitled to bring you on. And Limerick and your initial club will benefit in time if a big fee came in for you. So it's very important. That's a great point that caller in Mohill has made, because you must put the League of Ireland clubs in there as the journey. I'm talking from the bottom up, and we're talking about creating viable pathways for young players, but it's got to hit the League of Ireland on the way up, and the League of Ireland has to get stronger. And then if we bring in some foreign players into the League of Ireland, because that's what makes clubs and clubs and leagues stronger, if we can mix the two of them up and have the dynamic view to do that in the next 5 years, run it independently and even centrally in many respects, if the clubs would be up for something like that, you can then look at the top at the senior level and hope they do well, and maybe even add players into it who could come straight from League of Ireland clubs. So yeah, that was a great point.
You're setting up your new business now. Well, it started up.
It's been 15 months now full time, and we were a year beforehand. You have a small business, Global eShop Solutions, and this is a day job. So the real world hit me between the eyes a while ago, and although I love it, you know,
did you take a hammering in the crash?
I did on some property that I'd invested in, but I also, you know, hadn't been too stupid with my money, and I had a pension pot, so I got through it. You know, it wasn't easy, and but you know, you feel better for having come through it. I know it sounds stupid, but we were all living on a little bit of a false island there for many years, and so I would actually think I'm healthier now. I work harder. I have a better balance, and losing lots of money and having to pay banks back money. Some people haven't been able to do it, and I know that, so I'm not treating this lightly. I was able to get through that. Wasn't easy, and at the time, you know, devastated, but looking back now, I think it's made me stronger and better and more equipped to come in here and have conversations with you about the future of football, about even my own business. I think you're only as good as your experiences and what you take from them and how you turn them into a positive future for you. But no, there's no shame in having a go at something and not doing well. I learned that in football. You get up off the ground if you've fallen over and missed a good chance.
Yeah.
You score the next one. That's what matters. And that's exactly how I feel about business.
Okay. And how will this work? It's a platform for influencers.
Well, yes.
Who are influencers?
Marion, you're an influencer. A huge influencer.
I wouldn't think so.
Yeah, no. So it's a social media play, really, in as much that we build online stores for influencers all over the world who can quickly put their store into use and, you know, attract their own followers into the store. By virtue that with the brands, we've done deals with 7,000 brands to get lovely discount off all the top brands. And it's a new play in many respects on, I suppose, traditional commerce and e-commerce plays, in that we actually make the store belong to the influencers. The influencer's store, you're buying from the influencer. You're not being deflected off to buy at some other site. The goods would all be on the influencer's site. You would have one payment as you go in if you bought three or four different things. It's starting to get very exciting for us. We have a second platform called Mashapa, which Aisling named with her Irish background, her Conor na Gaeilge background. And Mashapa launches in New York in quarter one 2019, which is for all individuals to have their own shop, regardless of your power of influence. And then we would have a play then for independent high street retailers where we can bring online into the store. So it's an exciting time. I sound now as if I'm some kind of expert on it. I'm not. I hit 50 and I know it was a midlife crisis or whatever, but we're going well. I'm really determined to make this thing work.
Okay. Just before you go, because it's been in the news so much and a political hot potato in many ways, a lot of people remember your ad, "Can you see the sky?" You could get, and
yes,
rural Ireland said, "Phew."
Yeah, well, we did very well. We had 8,000 customers at one stage at QSAT in our height, and the other players started to come into the market. And you know, when I look back, and I suppose, you know, the broadband plan that seems to be in a bit of disarray at the moment, it was probably like that in our time. We might have been a bit early, but, you know, I feel a little bit for Minister Nocht, as he was at the time, who's, you know, kind of lost his job over being approached by runners in the game. But because I remember I went into Minister Rabbit at the time to say, look, we can do this for rural Ireland. It's so easy for you to get it. And you know, there was a rural programme that had been put in place, a rural broadband programme, and we went for it, and we applied to get in that, and that's when I spoke to Minister Rabbit, and we got it. But it turns out that people were asked, if you wanted rural broadband, get in touch, but they were asked to do it on the internet.
Listen, don't talk to
won't
me.
Go there.
We'll be talking about the weather later on here, and we can say keep an eye on, you know, on broadband and look it up online. And I'm talking to 500. Yes. Well, I'm not talking to 500,000 people,
well, yes,
but there
a lot of people wouldn't have their broadband.
Yeah.
So that happened, but at the same time, you know, I did go in and make an impassioned plea to Minister Rabbit that you can do a very quick win here for rural Ireland if you just paid their installation fee. That's people, they'll pay their monthly bills. Nobody has a problem with monthly bills. And we got the business going really well. So Minister Rabbit wasn't sacked for me going in to see him, but it wasn't that big a deal. But I do have sympathy for Minister Nocton, because I think it's been proved since that it was of no value or consequence whatsoever. Right.
And your QSAT ended.
It did end, yeah. We were in a formal dispute with our supplier, and inexplicably they switched it off as part of a bigger process that they had, and we lost our customers overnight. Could have dived into the courts, might do still if they get a big rescue package, but they're a company that's in trouble, and it's been a disappointing end. But we've found employment for everybody, and we come out of it, lesson learned, as I said earlier, makes me even more determined to do the next one.
Okay, listen, thank you very, very much indeed. Lots of people seriously interested in your idea. Niall Quinn, thank you very much indeed for talking to us.
Great to be here. Thanks, Marion.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.